I came across this book, I think it was thanks to Rabbi Ehrenfeld, who's my literary advisor in all things. And I usually don't have time during the Zman, during the regular Kolol period, to read, so I had a chance to read it over Pesach, and it struck me as an awesome book to discuss on many levels. If you haven't had a chance to read it, do not be intimidated. You might not know anything about math or psychology. I don't know much about either, and I still enjoyed the book. I found there was a lot to think about. But maybe before we talk about that, we should think about why Neely is doing a book club in the first place. First of all, I look around this room. Everybody has better things to do than just sit around and hang out. I mean, it would be fun to do that, but we could probably be learning. We could probably be having, I don't know, a shir or a chavrusa or some other, you know, important, you know, effort, some project. And yet we chose to initiate a book club. So I think there are a few layers to think about, a couple of ideas that we want to think about in terms of the value and the significance of a book club. And it's certainly from a religious standpoint. You know, we are, as a community, we're focused on growing as Jewish people, as thinking and inspired Jews. So perhaps the primary motivation for a book club, you could say, is Einod Melvado. There's nothing outside of godliness. Godliness is what envelops our world. And in a certain sense, we want to think about all the things that we do in our life and how they fit into an integrated Torah personality. And that means what we do with our, you know, vocation, what we do with our avocation, what kind of recreation we do. It all has to fit together in terms of a holistic religious personality. And so Rav Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, in one of his essays, the essay is called The End of Learning, The Goal of Learning, Rav Lichtenstein talks about the value of studying humanities. And he talks about the idea of understanding Tzelem Elokim, the Ruach Mamal, the speaking spirit, the human spirit, and how oftentimes this is taught to us not just through Torah, which of course is the primary way to understand the Dvar Hashem, the Word of God, but also through humanities in general. And so when we think about what we read and what we spend our time on, so understanding a broad definition of the Dvar Hashem, of relating to Hashem in our lives, can be extremely significant. So that's why choosing different things to read is important. I would say there's probably another element, which is just sometimes we need a break. We need an escape. So sometimes we read just to get away from the moment. But a lot of times, and in a book like this I found, a lot of times we read because we are challenged and we are inspired and we think about things differently. And different people approach this in different ways. I could tell you that for Nechama, it's sometimes very annoying. Like, we'll go somewhere, or we once went to the Shakespeare Theater, and like halfway through the play, I'm wondering, like, this would make a very good cheer, this thing. She's like, can you just enjoy the play? It doesn't always have to build into something. So it can get annoying for people like that. But, you know, Yosef Berman and I used to talk about that, where, like, the Hebrew, there's an expression called a chafran. You know, you're always, sometimes you don't have to think so much. But the idea of what we take in and how it affects us and what it causes us to think and how it causes us to think, it could be really powerful. And I think this book really makes you think if you have some time. You don't have to read the whole book. You can scan the book. But it just makes you think. It makes you think about who we are as people, as human beings, and why we are that way. And what is it that we do and why we do it. It challenges the assumptions that we have about ourselves, about the decisions that we make as individuals, as a society. The summary of the book, without too many spoilers, but it's not that dramatic, is about two little yidduch, two psychologists, two experts and game changers in the world of psychology and economics, Amos Tversky, Olav HaShalom, and Daniel Kahneman, Lahavdo Ben Achayim Ben Achayim. Kahneman was the child of a Holocaust survivor, Tversky, child of Zionist pioneers, and they essentially revolutionized the world of probability and economics and psychology with their ideas, and they kind of, the story, the book is the story of their lives, first independent of each other and then crossing paths, and the book begins with an application of this revolutionary way of thinking. A lot of it has to do with data-driven. This guy, Michael Lewis, He is obviously a really bright and accomplished guy because he wrote some very important books. For those who have not read the book or watched the movie Moneyball, so this is about the Oakland A's and the way that baseball has changed. That's the beginning of the book, because the premise of that is the research that Tversky and Kahneman did. So it's the story of their research, it's the story of their lives, and the title of the book is The Undoing Project. Now I wonder, I'm not sure why he chose the title. I don't think in the book he tells you why he chose the title for the book, but I suspect that the reason that he chose this title is because the project that they were undertaking is undoing everything we thought about ourselves, about how we think and how we make decisions. We have a certain certainty about why we choose what we choose or why we decide to do what we do. And yet, what they show over and over again is that it is so easily tricked. Our mind is so easily tricked into thinking something other than what we should really be thinking. You know, they took this, they have millions of awesome research experiments in here. Some of them are totally hilariously ridiculous, and some of them are really complex. So they took a group of students and they had them approximate the number, the sum total of 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times 5 times 6 times 7 times 8. And they got the approximation. I don't know how many people here could do that off the top of their head, but they approximated. Then they did the same thing, 8 times 7 times 6 times 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1. So you would think that the answer would be the same, but it's not. Because when you start with the number 8, everybody thinks big. So you had a much higher average than you did when you started with the number 1. Interesting. Yeah. They did all these mind games, and not just on, you know, random people who, you know, never thought about anything. They did these on their students, graduate students, old people from all different backgrounds, and they showed how there are various, what they called heuristics, various variables, different little aspects of our minds that cause us to associate and to come to certain decisions in certain ways. And so what it does is it takes what we thought was 100% certain and makes it not so certain. All of a sudden, there is an uncertainty that's involved. You know, we used to think... We used to think that experts, and this is the first chapter, that experts can predict who the best basketball players will be in the NBA. The NBA draft experts will tell you who the best draft picks are going to turn out. And they found that, actually, the experts are not necessarily experts. If you use a mathematical theory, a data-driven theory, you'll come out ahead of some of the experts, and that's what the whole Moneyball story is about. So it's challenging our assumptions, our certainty. It's not so certain. What we thought was so obvious, the decisions that we made that we thought were detached from any negia, any personal, it's totally not true. There are so many things. And this has spawned, I don't know how many people here are into Freakonomics or Malcolm Gladwell. Yeah. Right? What's the whole yesod of Freakonomics and Malcolm Gladwell? It's that the things that you're seeing are not necessarily correlated to the causes that you thought they were. You know, you might think that the reason why there are X number of ketchup bottles in the supermarket aisle versus the number of mustard bottles... I once heard a whole podcast from Malcolm Gladwell about this. Like, why is it that there are 50 kinds of mustard and only 2 kinds of ketchup? So you might think that it's A, and if you think that, then you're going to go out and try to build a better ketchup, a better mousetrap. But in fact, it's actually based on B. It has nothing to do with it. You might think that the enrollment in a certain college dips in a particular year because, you know, some SAT something or other, but it could be it's because there was a water shortage in some community somewhere 20 years ago, so the children had to move, and it's not what you thought it was. There's an uncertainty. There's a, wait a second, you take a step back and realize, you know what? There's a lot more complexity here than I thought, or what I thought isn't really what I was thinking. Like, there was something going on under my thought. There was some other factor that I didn't convey, and I think that has two, like, meta thoughts that go into it. The first is, it should make us feel a little bit better about ourselves, I think. Like, it's okay to be human. We're all human. And everybody makes mistakes. Even the so-called experts make mistakes. A big piece in the book is about a physician in Toronto who's picking up on tons of mistakes that are being made in the medical field. Apparently, what they say in the book, I can't tell you if it's true or not true, but they say apparently that medical errors in hospitals are responsible for more annual deaths in the United States than car accidents.
Well, that's, I mean, that's what I was saying too, that was like, you know, before like this whole shift in how people practice medicine, where it's very like evidence-based medicine, like case studies, and like you have algorithms basically that you use, you know, so you don't have to stop and think. So we take it for granted that that's how it is. I mean, in the not so far distant past, it wasn't that way, and people made mistakes because they thought about it, you know what I mean? Because they thought, well, you know, this is what, I mean, this makes sense, so this is where I'm going. You know, like you were talking about, like, a patient was in a car accident and she had a heart arrhythmia, but they had seen on her chart that she had a thyroid problem, so they attributed that to the arrhythmia, but really that wasn't, really she had like a collapsed lung or something like that. So I feel like there were all these like steps that, like, you know, your mind works in a certain way, so you just follow, you know, but they basically came up with all these kind of algorithms or kind of, you know, preset paths so that
decision
you,
trees.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so that you don't get mixed up with that, I guess. And,
so that's one half, which is it makes you feel a little better about yourself. On the other half, and I think it helps deal with some pernicious media called gaiva, hubris. It says that we shouldn't be so sure of ourselves all the time. So those are kind of my initial background thoughts. So anybody who had a chance to read the article, the summary from last year online, or anybody read the book, I had a couple of thoughts, but did anybody come across any interesting observations that you saw in this book, any themes that stood out to you? That's okay. Any thoughts?
Yeah. Structured the love I've ever been to.
No, class for sure.
I just think the one thing, because I'm a social worker,
sorry.
I picked up on this, and I don't know if anybody else would agree with me or not, but Daniel Kahneman felt that he was not influenced by his childhood and so forth. But I think he very much was influenced by his childhood, of what had happened to him during the Holocaust. And as a survivor, a constant feeling of uncertainty.
That's interesting.
And I think that was possibly what drew him into this to some extent, although he probably never would have admitted that, or he didn't recognize it in himself.
So I don't know. I don't know him personally, but what you're pointing out is that the author, Michael Lewis, contrasts significantly over the book the personalities of Kahneman and Tversky, that Tversky is like Mr. Go-Getter, super confident, loud, the life of the party, and Kahneman, like, every time he has an idea, he just doubts himself. He's like, oh, that's really, like, that's not even worth anything. And, you know, they go back and forth, these two, and that's an interesting point, meaning Kahneman being born in that context and seeing his father die, and, you know, it's an interesting observation. Any other thoughts? I guess I'll carry on then. I had a few. I did read the book and I prepared. So I think one, at least to me, the most powerful aspect of the book is the idea of a mystery. Because they leave it is the undoing project. They leave it as a mystery. Because they haven't solved every heuristic, every factor that goes into the decisions that we make. Some of them have to do with association. Some of them have to do with, like, the size of the number, the availability, anchoring, framing, different things that they use. But the idea that it's a mystery, that, you know, we think we figured it out, and then we realize that we haven't really figured it out. And so for people who are caught up in that, it could be, I guess it could be kind of depressing. It reminds me of the book of Koheles. Like, at the end of the day, what is Koheles telling you? Koheles telling you is that there's a mystery. That on the one, there are so many contradictions in Koheles. On the one hand, you say, you know, Simcha is terrific, and then you say Simcha Mazu Osa, because depending on what the frame is, you can have the same, you know, object looked at in different ways. And then there's the deeper mystery, the mystery of Eov. Eov's a guy, whether he lived or didn't live, he's telling the story of suffering throughout the ages. And he doesn't get satisfactory. He doesn't get a clear answer at the end of the book of Eov. the end of Job is a mystery. God comes to him out of the whirlwind and asks him, he says, you know, were you there at the creation? Do you understand the world? The world is a mystery. And that's how he leaves it. So this story, it really tells you that when we unpack ourselves, we're going to find that same mystery. Like, we think we know, when we're making a decision, we think we know why we're making that decision, but you know what? When we dig a little bit deeper, maybe we don't really know. Maybe there's something else, and maybe it's not even in our own past. Maybe there's something that's happening around us. I was discussing this with Rabbi Ehrenfeld. Could you imagine that if you were up for parole, he quoted to me, I didn't finish, I read a little bit of Daniel Kahneman's other book called Thinking Fast and Slow. This one he wrote by himself. There was a parole board that sat all day just looking at applicants for parole. So they checked. They figured out when they were most likely to give clemency and parole and when they were not. Well, they sat all day. So after breakfast, you had a good chance. After about 3 hours of sitting there, not so much. After lunch, spike in parolees, and then it dies down.
Yeah, that's like when you're supposed to have meetings. Like, they schedule meetings like at those
same
intervals
thing with
also.
Productivity. Yeah. Say, don't make meetings in the morning, use your morning hours. And then in the afternoon, like calls and things.
Mm-hmm.
All the productivity experts say.
Or directly after lunch, because then people are like,
they have a little high.
Yeah. Like 10 and 3 are like your best.
But like, don't waste your freshest time in the morning,
right,
on meetings and calls. You're going to be doing your most challenging work.
So if you ask the guys in the parole office, do they think that they were being honest and fair to all the applicants for parole? What do you think they would say?
I'm sure they would say yes, but you have to recognize there's an inherent bias. And I think anybody who does any kind of work has to know that. I mean, my job often makes me work many hours in a row. And depending, I mean, I know the quality of my work at 9 a.m., if I've slept that night, is of better quality than the stuff I'm looking at 11 p.m. Sometimes the stuff I do at 2 a.m., I get in rhythm and I'm jamming and like it's good, but there's a quality factor when you're not sleeping or you've done a repetitive task for a long time, and it matters, and you have to recognize that.
So that's their point. You have to recognize that. And so often, like the research that they talk about here in this hospital in Toronto is that you have physicians who are on for X number of hours in a row, and they're trained in a certain way to diagnose things with a certain set of assumptions, but all of a sudden, maybe those assumptions aren't really true. And that's what this outsider is there. And what does he do? He asks questions. And that's part of the answer. You know, somebody coming into a job, they may not know. I don't know. How many people know that your best work is done in the morning? You know?
Right.
Unless you're trained in that, you
unless
may not
you
know.
Go to a productivity class.
I'm saying like now it's fairly talked about, I feel like.
Right, but you wouldn't necessarily know. If you were a
person. It would be different. Some people are morning people, some people are night people. So it depends on the person who, you know, they know their schedule, they know where
they're morning. I feel like the mean, right?
But like, whether you're more, some people, their morning starts in the office at 7 or whatever, wherever you work. Not everyone's in the office, but. Some people are in the office at 7 and some people are in the office at 10, but they say that when you start your day, whatever time that is, then that's your most productive, focused time. Save your hardest task.
So that's just one example of the mystery, you know, the uncertainty that you wouldn't necessarily see. You have to dig below the surface and peel away all these layers and, you know, figure out. I'll skip to the end of the book, the coda of the book, where they describe about how you phrase a question about applying for a school lunch program will affect thousands of kids, whether they're going to go hungry for lunch. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about what their parents have access to in low-income areas, if you're telling them you need to opt in or opt out, well, that may affect whether kids get meals and whether they do better in school. So whether or not your school district is failing or succeeding may have nothing to do with your teachers. It may have to do with how you filled out the questionnaire for your parents.
Same thing with referendums, right, that they vote on. I mean, how many of those are worded in such a way that
mm-hmm.
people vote
it's
yes,
all the framing.
No. I mean, I still don't remember when there was those like all the propositions about whether it's abortion or marriage rights or all those things. All those are worded with like triple double negatives. You know, no one knows what these are. Which side are these people on because of the way
exactly worded? So I think there's a big uncertainty. It's like the pasuk says, "V'ra'isa sacharai ufanai lo yiro." You don't see the face of Hashem. You don't see the whole picture. You only see one piece of it, and then you can unpack another piece and another piece. But recognizing that in life, there's a mystery out there, and the more we learn, the more we realize there's uncertainty. We don't know. We don't have the answers.
But that's kind of easy for you to say, I think, coming like from the perspective of someone who like believes in God. Like, they're both atheists, like, coming, you know, like, and he makes a point of saying that over and over in the book. And I know that's not, like, anything unusual for a scientist to be an atheist, but I feel like a lot of what they're dealing with are those like in-betweens and shades of gray and like inner workings of like the human mind and stuff like that. And they don't bring that, you know, they're not coming, they're not, their research isn't informed by
right.
That.
So what I'm suggesting is that what they're researching, even though it comes from a completely secular vantage point, is actually not at odds. I think it actually complements to a great extent what a traditional belief would say.
I mean, if we have this much trouble understanding each other and you can influence people by wording your question in certain ways, and we have such a bias interpreting relatively simple situations, how much more complicated can we not see God's plan in the world, you know? That's what I kept thinking about when you're talking, was, oh, Lord, if I can't even do 8 times 7 backwards and get to 1,200 or whatever, like, or, I mean, then how am I, I give up, I'll just go do my thing and I've got to figure it out. But, I mean, it's also interesting what you were saying about how he doesn't think that his childhood was influenced by that, which to me just seems...
Oh, no, it's
sure.
To
me,
it seemed that he didn't, that on some conscious level, he didn't want it to influence him. But did it... Definitely, of course, on a very unconscious level, and sort of, I think, anyway, this might be, that it definitely did. And how he approached a lot of things, his own doubt and uncertainty came to me, my interpretation is, that from his very, very uncertain and difficult childhood.
So, bringing it back to Rachel's point, I don't know if it's a contradiction. I think it's a complementary point, at least to me, that the uncertainty and the mystery that they're describing can be very well appreciated from a religious standpoint.
I'm sure it can. I just feel like that's like, these are like classic examples, right? Like the like believing person looks, you know, looks at it one way, and the non-believing person looks at it another way, and I don't know, they're not always in direct conflict, they're just This is how it always happens. Like, this is how it's always described. But you see what you want to see. I mean, it goes back to like the whole book, right? You see what you want to see in anything.
So Rav Amital, on that point, Rav Amital Zichrono Livracha was the Rosh Hashiva of Yeshiva Har Etzion, the co-Rosh Hashiva with Rav Lichtenstein for many years. So Rav Amital apparently once had a discussion after the war. He was a Holocaust survivor. His name was not Amital. His name was Klein, as a young man in Hungary, in Romania, wherever exactly the shtetl was that he lived. He was in a labor camp. His family was killed. So he once had a brief discussion with somebody who was not a believer about the Holocaust. So apparently Rav Amital said to this person, he said, you know, look, you have questions and I have questions. Neither of us have good answers. So are you any better off than I am? Meaning, if you don't believe in God, that doesn't mean you have any better answers to what happened to us than if you do believe in God. We both have questions. There's the uncertainty for both. So that's, I think that's part of the story. Another piece of the uncertainty that we can think about has to do with a very famous saying of Rabbi Shlomo Carlebach. Probably one of the most famous things that Shlomo Carlebach was known to say was, you never know. I have a great book at home. Terrific book if anybody's into Karl Bach stories. It's called Lamed Vav. First of all, the story biography of Reb Shlomo called Holy Brother is phenomenal reading. We should do that for a book club, by the way. We should do Holy Brother. It's super kedai. Very easy read, very inspiring, amazing. Holy Brother Super Kedai. So he has a book, Lamed Vav, of the Hasidic stories that he used to tell. One entire chunk of that book, called Lamed Vav, great book, is devoted to the You Never Know stories. It's like the dusty baker who turns out to be Eliyahu HaNavi, and the guy who shows up at your door, the schlepper who turns out to be Avraham Avinu, and vice, and, you know, V'chein V'chein, the Schwarzwolf, and the you know, Yasla, the holy miser, all these stories. Because what Shlomo was trying to tell you is that you never know what's going on in somebody else's world. We're so certain we have it figured out. We understand why they did what they did. I can't believe they said that to me or they did that to me. Because I know what was going on in their life at that time. I have a measure of certainty. So I'm going to project. I'm going to talk about, in my own mind, I'm going to tell myself, this is the explanation. And Rabbi Shlomo says, you never know. You never know. And all of a sudden the research is bearing out the fact that, you know what, Taka, you really do never know. On two levels. Number one, you never know what's going on in that person's life. But what you see from this research, which is so amazing, is that you never even know what's going on in your own mind that's causing you to interpret the situation in a certain way. What's the frame that I am in that's causing me to interpret that in that way? It could be that the you never know is actually on my side. It's because I have an assumption, I have an association that makes me interpret that in a certain way. What's the first chapter in terms of the basketball? He's very into this basketball analogy. So one of the big things is, does the person who the scout is looking at remind them of a great basketball player? So if the person in front of you reminds you of a great basketball player, then you'll go with that. If they remind you of a lousy basketball player, then... But it has nothing to do with them. It has nothing to do with their skill. It's in your mind what you perceive a great basketball player. So if I have a conversation with somebody and that conversation subconsciously or unknowingly reminds me of another conversation, well, that my attitude is going to be different. Right? On a simpler, more basic level, many of us, those of us who have had the opportunity to name our own children, you know, we're not going to name our child. If you know the other snotty kid growing up who had that name, you're not going to name your kid that name.
That's why Itai is not a different name. Because I wanted a different name. I love Itai now. And like, I mean, there's another name I've been waiting for and Dylan refused because of another person named that name and he couldn't handle it.
He's like, I don't want every time I see my kid to be thinking about that.
Like, it's a beautiful name.
He's like, I can't.
Yeah, but I feel like I can go the other way too. Because, like, Emmett, Asher came up with that, like, on Yom Kippur, but also that was the year that, like, Emmett Smith was inducted into the Hall of Fame.
That's what I always
and I'm like,
thought.
I don't mind Emmett Smith. Like, okay, fine, whatever. I'll be raising a football player. Cool. But,
sort of.
Emmett Hill kind of weirded me out, like, a little bit. So, like, I feel like sometimes you can get past your associations.
Not for
the eyes. Emmett Smith had the best eyes of any running back.
I mean,
you see the eyes?
Like really talented, so it wouldn't be the worst thing if my child.
But it was all in the eyes. You ever see the eyes?
No.
When he would look in. Oh, whatever. Not for now.
He's kind of a football player.
I mean, he'd like to be. I don't
want
to, like, burst his bubble.
No, I think we all did that. I did that. I knew someone with the name of my son, and he was a really great guy. And when we needed a name with a certain, with an ass, whatever, I just thought of this guy and I said, you know what? I hope my son grows up to be like this guy.
Right. So you have these associations in your mind, but a lot of times, and what they're telling you in the book, so many times, that's what the chiddush of this book is, and their research is you're not realizing it. You're not thinking it. You know, when it's the snotty kid that you hated in high school, so you know, I can't name my kid that because of that person. But what they're pointing out is that just scratching beneath the surface, you'll realize that there's something else at work here. And you didn't even think about it, and you didn't know it. We're going to have to demonstrate it to you. If we asked you, you would deny it, and you would sincerely deny it, because you don't realize that it's happening. But it is happening. So Shlomo says, you never know. You never know because you never know what's going on in that person's life, but you never know also because your interpretation is framed by whatever's going on in the back of your mind. So it's true, the uncertainty is true about life, it's true about other people, and I would say that one of the amazing things is that it's true about ourselves. That's what it's showing you. The Gemara has a phrase, Al tamin ba'atzmecha ad yom moscha. Never trust yourself until the day of death. The Gemara tells a story about a very righteous Kohen Gadol who, after decades, became a heretic. He totally lost his way. Because, you know, we think we have ourselves in hand. We think we have ourselves in check. But sometimes there's something that just flicks a switch and we're just like, wait a second, I didn't anticipate that. I wasn't thinking about that. I didn't have that perspective. Do we always know every single thing that's going on in our mind? Everything that's affecting us? Everything that's like moving around in our orbit? Not always. And so this affects a big chunk of the book, our decision making. Right? One of the things, one of the great quotes here is that, I think it was Kahneman, not Tversky, who says, he finds that it's astonishing that we entrust a handful of people whose hormones are slightly more sophisticated than forest rats with a few buttons that can destroy all of humanity. The idea that we make decisions based on our gut, right? That's a big thing. We make gut-based decisions, right? Our gut-based... Well, they're pointing out that the gut-based decisions, that's usually associated with all kinds of indigestion, all kinds of, like, biases and preconceived notions that have nothing to do with our gut, has nothing to do with our bile, has nothing to do with anything except just made-up preconceived notions and heuristics that they can point out to you are all baloney. So how we make decisions is based on recognizing that we have these biases. It's interesting that in halacha, sometimes when you have a huge question, you see this often in responsa literature. In Europe, you will have a chacham who will receive a question, an earth-shattering question, a very, very significant question. He'll say, this is my answer, but I'd like you to consult with two other great rabbinic authorities before I'm willing to sign off on this. Yes. So the question is, why is the rabbi doing that? Is it because he's a coward? Is it because he doesn't have the guts to stand behind his psak? Or is it because he recognizes that his analysis is only one way of looking at something? And if you challenge it from another viewpoint, it may reveal something about the analysis, which is flawed. The same way that the doctors in the hospital in Toronto needed to be challenged by this kind of like roving questioning guy who just keeps asking them, well, did you do this? Did you do that? Sometimes, you know, we get it set in a way of thinking, but if somebody else asks us, somebody else looks at it, they'll point out something that's very obvious. That's why it's so important when you talk about answering questions. In halacha, Rav Shechter likes to quote that there are two halachas. There's one called Mora Halacha Befnei Rabbo. You don't pass a question when your Rebbe is there. But there's another aspect of that that's not just about Kavod Harav, that you should have respect for your Rebbe. It's because you're just being irresponsible. If you answer a question without checking with somebody who knows more than you, so you're not doing your due diligence. If you pass a Shiloh, so Rav Shechter says today, it's not necessarily your Rebbe, it might be a safer. So why would you answer off the top of your head if you could just look it up in the Mishnah Berurah or in the Aruch HaShulchan or in the Rambam? We need to check. So why are you checking? Is it because you don't know? The answer is there's always that uncertainty, that application. That's maybe why there's something called Shimush in Horah. You know, I'm not on the Paskening Shiloh circuit. That's why we have great community rabbis. But sometimes through the Taras HaMishpacha hotline, sometimes I'm called upon to answer a particular question. So usually, when I'm asked about these questions, I use this as an opportunity to call one of my rabbeim to discuss with him. Because even if I see the question in a certain way, well, these people are experts who have been dealing with these same questions for 20 or 30 years, and they may answer the same halakhic question with a different set of assumptions or a different frame that I maybe never heard of. So if you have that measure of uncertainty about yourself, and you say, you know what, I don't know it all. Maybe there's somebody who can ask another question. Maybe I'm looking at it with a bias. Maybe I'm being too machmir in this situation. Maybe I'm being too makil in this situation. Maybe I'm not asking the right questions and somebody else would ask a better question or a different kind of question. How often is it that you can call the same rabbi with the same question 3 days in a row and get three different answers? So sometimes that's because of the change of perspective of the rabbi, sometimes it's because of the change of the circumstance, and lots of different things in between. But the idea that there is a prospect of uncertainty is built into the halachic system, that responsible mori hora know that these things are out there. And it's interesting to be aware of what's our own bias. You know, and we could try to unpack that as much as possible, but it's difficult to figure that out. You know, what is it that is, you know, framing the answer that I'm giving that relates to this person. So there's the world uncertainty, there's the uncertainty vis-a-vis others, and then there's uncertainty in ourselves. And that, I think, is a big part of the halachic system, which is now part of a move to maybe two other points. It's a big, I think there's a big tumult, there's a big discussion in the world. Certainly it's true in the world of sports. When it comes to the question of technology and human input, what's the balance? When do we trust people and when do we prefer to go with technology? I'll give an example. Instant replay.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that.
Right?
In baseball.
In baseball. Yeah. Baseball just came around to instant replay. It had been in football for a while, but instant replay in baseball. Now, not all plays in football are reviewable and not all plays in baseball are reviewable. But what's the instant replay debate? The instant replay debate is this nexus between technology and human input. Yes, it would be more scientific if all of baseball would be governed exclusively by computers. We could have sensors on the bases. We could totally disavow umpires and not have any need for umpires.
Yeah, and put GPS in the ball, and when does it arrive there, and where? And put GPS in the player's shoes.
But we don't do that. Why not?
Take all the fun out.
Yeah. you've lost the soul of the game, so to speak. So isn't that the relationship between the data-driven and the gut decisions? But what's interesting is that they point out at the beginning of the book is that the data is not the be-all and end-all, because the data just shows that there's more uncertainty. There's no one specific formula that will tell you with 100% certainty who the Houston Rockets should choose. That's one very poignant line when the general manager says that the owner is looking for certainty. And he says, I work with data, but I can't give you certainty. There's always a measure of uncertainty. So there is a push-pull between the technology and the human input. So that's true also when it comes to halacha. There is an objective standard in halacha, and then there is a human factor. The Netziv and the Beis Halevi, both from the school of Volozhin in different places and different ways in the 19th century, addressed this idea that the Luchos Shnios were given to humanity. So that means that we decide when Yontif is. The Bezdin might be wrong. They might have the wrong day for Pesach, but you know what? That's okay. We're going to celebrate Pesach when the Bezdin, when the rabbinic court says that's when Pesach is, that's what we're going to go with. It's astronomically incorrect, doesn't matter, because the Torah is given to us. So here you have another similar tension. You know, the date is wrong. It's not true, and yet we still observe it that way. So here you have a huge aspect of life that we're seeing now more and more sharply, the question of technology and data versus human experience. And Judaism is very much on the cusp of that same question.
Hashem didn't give the Torah to the blind. Like, he didn't want it to be done perfectly. He wanted it to be done with human beings, right?
And so that means that it has to be open to interpretation, and that interpretation may make sense, and sometimes it may make mistakes. There is the whole Masechta. We do not believe in rabbinic infallibility. There's a whole Masechta called Horios, which is predicated on the idea that rabbis make mistakes. And that's okay. It's all right. Everybody makes mistakes. Great doctors make mistakes. Great rabbis make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. That's okay.
We just had that gigantic computer hack. So we can't rely on that. We don't rely on computers for everything. Then what?
Yeah. Look, Mrs. Kraft and I have this ongoing debate. She doesn't know what this is. She's never seen one of these in use before.
I have.
She has.
Like a long time ago.
Yeah. She only uses this machine that I see. She brings in. She says she has a file. I said, where's the file? I have one right here. It says the undoing project. It's off-white. I'll put this in here, and then it'll go in my basement in a cabinet. So, you know, there are different strokes for different folks on that one.
We're not that far apart in age, I'm just saying. You're dating yourself.
Right. Well, now my beard is gone, so I'm much younger. But the idea that the idea that technology has pluses and minuses and how it impacts our learning. And then the other thing I thought that was really interesting has to do with the loss and gain question that they talk about. How much would people risk to gain $500 versus lose $500? So it's interesting how they explore this question of the gain versus the loss, the $500, the betting. And that what they found was you can have the same statistical probability and end up at the same place. But if you're going to get there through a loss, you're risk averse. If you're going to get there through a gain, you're going to be more willing to take the risk. And so there is this idea, this fear of losing out, this fear of missing, but the difference between gaining versus losing. Well, where are you gaining and where are you losing? So the answer is, they say it's from a, first he says, it's from a point of reference. It's your status quo, it's your point of reference. So wherever you are at any point, any given point, that's your frame of reference. So below that, you're losing. You're going to feel one way versus above that. Even though in 2 weeks, you could be at this higher place, you're going to feel differently about going back to the previous place because it's a different point of reference. There's a great book by a guy by the name of Daniel Pink. It's called To Sell as Human. He makes this point and develops it significantly about, are you wealthy? Well, compared to what? Are you happy? Compared to what? He points out that everything is relative. So many things in our lives are relative. So what Tversky and Kahneman are pointing out, that this is true in terms of our risk aversion, our decision making. Everything is relative. And this goes back to your point before about referendum. When they write a referendum, they're going to frame it in such a way that it's going to be depicted in these terms. How do they want it to feel? Do they want you to feel like you're gaining something or like you're losing something? The language is going to make all the difference. It's the same end result. You're at the same $2,000 mark. It's just the frame is different. So what's interesting is that the Torah and the Halacha is very sensitive to this. There's a concept in Hilchos Tzedakah called Dei Machsoro. It's Gemara Ksubas. The Gemara says that you could have somebody who was at, you know, a very high socioeconomic level, and then something happens to them, and they're impoverished, quote unquote. You know, they used to be earning $350,000 a year, and now they're earning $150,000. So the Gemara says many people would be looking to earn $150,000. They'd be very, very jealous of that. They'd be ecstatic to be told they're going to earn $150,000. But for this person who went from $350,000 down to $150,000, they're devastated. And so from a Hilchos Tzedakah standpoint, you need to rehabilitate that person. You need to give them day machzor, the amount that they're losing. Now, I'm not speaking practically here because there are a lot of other tzedakah needs that are going to take precedence before the person who's going to go back to their 350 lifestyle. And so that's not necessarily at the top of your priority list in terms of you also need to make sure that, of course, the people who really need the basics get it first. But isn't that interesting? That the halacha recognizes that there's a psychological impact based on your status quo. And so we need to think about that, and we need to think about how that relates to other people. You know, for us, I'll give you an example. We all go through life and we meet people who experience loss. And so depending on who that person is and what their frame is, they'll experience it in a different way. So somebody may lose a grandmother or a grandfather, let's take that example. And they weren't particularly close with that person, or they were, and they passed away when they were younger. They died, they had a long life. They died at the age of 90 with a good life. They had a lot to be grateful for. And then someone else has the same loss. But that person's loss is experienced differently because the relationship that they had with that person was different. Or the other family members that they had in their family had a different dynamic. So from my perspective, that kind of loss is one kind of loss. But from theirs, it's a totally different experience. Their, you know, their day machsoro is very different. For somebody else to lose a grandmother, maybe it's not such a big deal for them. Maybe they have other grandparents. Maybe they have other relatives. They have other support system. Maybe they weren't close to that person. But maybe for me to lose a grandparent, maybe that's the only person they have left in their life. Maybe that's their anchor. Maybe that's their identity. So understanding where the person is coming from and what their reference point is a really deep idea. So it's difficult for us to go back to Shlomo, you never know. You know, what they're telling you in the book is to really understand where somebody is gaining and losing, you have to understand what their reference point is. Where did they grow up? You know, when they come to work in your company, or they come over for a Shabbos meal, what's their frame of reference for a Shabbos meal? Like, what's their frame of reference for a conversation? So many times we have a conversation with people, and they are frustrated about something that to us sounds totally, it's totally insignificant. They're totally blowing it out of proportion. But we have to understand what's their de machsor, what's their point of reference. You know, for somebody, if they lost $10 in their car, so they might feel like $10, okay, it's, you know, I've lost many things that are worth much more than $10. Come, will attest to that. Not this week, but I've lost many more things. So, okay, I lost $10. But for someone else, $10, that might be their groceries for the week. So understanding that de machsoro, understanding what's the gain and loss, yes, on one hand, it's true for, you know, advertisers and marketing people and manipulating referenda, but it's also true for understanding where people are coming from and really digging down to where their heart is at. You know, what's affecting them? What are they feeling? It comes back to that. Yeah.
Well, I think it relates back to Daniel Kahneman in terms of you think you can divorce yourself from certain things, but you can't really.
Right.
That they are so deeply ingrained that you can't even recognize them yourself, but they just play themselves out in a variety of ways.
Right.
Maybe that person who lost $10 is wealthy now, but had grown up in a very impoverished background, and that really would sort of blow that out of proportion rather than, and nobody would really know why,
right,
considering their current circumstances.
So the undoing project has undone all of our certainty in life, and I think it certainly has made us much more religiously sensitive for that. So we are grateful to them, and we're grateful to Rachel for hosting tonight. And